Into the Weird, Episode 18, Cosmic Obscenity and Cranial Combat.
Into the Weird, a podcast celebrating the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age. I'm your host, Billy D, and alongside me is my co-host, Herman Hellstrom Lowe. How are you, Herman?
Again, Billy, you flatter me. Thank you. If I could pick someone from the Bronze Age, I would definitely pick a guy who constantly, you know, displays his chest with this giant pentagram on it.
Uh-huh. Yep, and that was rocked, that six-pack of abs, too, yeah.
Damn, don't even talk about that. Aaron's been waiting for a six-pack for, what, decades now. I still haven't delivered, I promise.
Get her a six-pack of beer. Let's see, this is good enough.
certainly not Corona beer.
Ooh, yeah, no.
Can you believe it? Like, the sales of Corona has actually dropped, Billy. I can't believe that. I mean, how idiotic do people have to be to think that virus is linked with the beer? Crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot of goofy people out there. And it's sad, too, because that's a good beer.
Yeah, I don't mind it. It's a nice little social beer, you know. It hands you a little bit of a buzz, but not too much, you know, to have the evening deteriorate into a chaotic mess. I'm not I become a different person when I drink. So normally I'm like, you know, I curb myself when I'm in a social environment and there's alcohol involved. So, yeah, I'm not much of a drinker.
Me neither.
But coffee, oh yeah, I definitely love my coffee. I can get spiked on coffee anytime. And the occasional, you know, Steve Englehart doobie here and there. Why not?
Mushroom once in a while.
That stuff really hits me hard. No, all kidding aside here, listeners, we're not like that. We're not dependent on substances to keep ourselves going. We're dependent on comics. Right, Billy, the smell of an old back issue, newly arrived through eBay or wherever we bought it from, that really keeps me going.
Puts me That's the best high in the world, yeah.
Definitely. As long as you don't roll up those back issues and smoke it, you know, everything's fine.
Yeah, no, don't ever do that.
So, Billy, this time around, this is the big one, man. This is the episode I've been waiting for. You've been waiting for it. This is the Stephen Strange issue that kicked it all off, for me at least, as a kid reading it. It made me an unabashed fan of the Sorcerer Supreme for life and made him one of my favorite Bronze Age Marvel characters. One of my top three. You know, my favorite superhero character is definitely Stephen Strange from the Marvel Bronze Age. But then the other two are Morbius and Man-Thing. But, you know, like I say, if I'm looking at it as a whole, then I kind of can't pick between the three of them, you know, because each of them have their brilliant story arcs. And but superhero wise, Stephen Strange is definitely it for me when it comes to Marvel. So how about you? How do you feel? What impact did this issue, Marvel Premiere number 10, listeners, that's what we're talking about. What impact did this issue have on you, Billy?
Oh, it was huge, just because of the fact that you finally got to see, you know, Shumagorath, the guy that's been tormenting and sending these acolytes and minions after him since basically issue 3. That's how long this story's been culminating. So, you know, it was huge. Anytime you can, the payoff was huge, and it was excellent too.
That's right. That's right. I mean, so far he's just been a disembodied voice. Mm-hmm. We saw that briefly in the previous issue and in issues that came before. He's been, you know, arranging, you know, his coming, or actually this could be his second coming, his third coming. We don't know. I mean, he's been, you know, active on Earth before, but he takes these prolonged periods of sleep, kind of similar to the Great Old Ones, when you link it to Lovecraft mythology. And, you know, this is the one where he awakens again. And this is a pretty big deal because, like you say, we get to see him visually for the first time. And damn, what a great design. Obviously, it's taken from Cthulhu and from, you know, Lovecraft. But I'd say there's also a bit of Starro from the DC universe in there, wouldn't you say, Billy?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, you know, I mean, you can't nail it down and say for sure there was, but I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, in a memoir they might write later on, those two guys might say that was an inspiration.
Now that begs the question, Billy, who's your favorite Doctor Strange villain? I mean, Grant's favorite has always been Nightmare.
Oh,
and that's a great pick. Oh, is this a difficult question?
Yeah, this is a tough one. Shumagorath is awesome, but I really like Nightmare a lot too. And I really love the fiery-headed, flame-headed Dormammu as well. The dread Dormammu as well. Those top three guys, those are probably my three favorites, and it's almost like a 1A, B, and C, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because I'm heavily into things that frighten me and scare me. Dormammu, he's, you know, awesome in terms of, you know, he invokes all. He is definitely, in terms of power, he's near omnipotent, and Nightmare's scary as hell too. But, you know, I've seen scarier, reading a lot of horror comics, so it's not that they really terrify me. But Shumagorath, the look of him, he really just gets under my skin just because of this. It's this giant octopus-like body with this massive eyeball right in the middle. And you know I don't like these eyes being, you know, these eyeball horror things being thrown at me all the time. So Shumagorath freaks me out every time I look at him. And then these tentacles are not really octopus-like. They're more like worm-like almost. They've got these rings around them. It's segmented almost, these tentacles of his. And, you know, then obviously he's a cosmic obscenity, in the words of Stephen Strange, and he does look quite obscene. So because of that, I've always loved Shumagorath. He's my favorite Stephen Strange supervillain, or villain, I should say. But he's not my favorite Marvel villain, though. That would be reserved for Kang. I've always been a Kang fan. But in terms of Stephen Strange's, you know, cadre of villains, yeah, I'm going to have to go with old Shuma. Shuma G. All right, Billy, so I'm going to give a bit of a rundown here about the details concerning this issue, and then we can get into the synopsis. So are you ready for this, mate?
Oh, it sounds great, man.
Excellent. Here we go. All right, Marvel Premiere number 10, that's what we're discussing, listeners. Cover dated September 1973. The sale date was June 26th, 1973. Cover price was 20 cents. Page count 32, editor Roy Thomas, cover artist Frank Brunner. The title of this issue is finally Shumagorath. And yeah, it took quite a while for us to finally get to him. But here we are. And writer Steve Englehart, penciler Frank Brunner, inker Neil Adams. Neil Adams. Letterer John Constanza. Okay, now, listeners, if you want to read along with us and you don't have the issue at hand, pause and you can go find it on the Marvel Unlimited app. Marvel Premiere number 10. Look for that one. And you can also find it reprinted in the Essential Doctor Strange Volume 2. And then also Doctor Strange, A Separate Reality trade paperback. One of our listeners actually chimed in, Chase. Thanks, Chase, for that. And during our previous episode, we forgot to mention that Marvel Premiere number 9 and 10, this storyline that we're discussing, can be found in that newly released trade paperback. It's not really one of Marvel's epic collections, is it, Billy?
No, I think it's just one of their... I'm trying to think of what they call them now. But it's it's not an epic. It's just a... What do they even call them? Like a... I can't even think of it off the top of my head. Because they've changed so often. Like, they've changed a lot of them over the years. Where it was like, you know, they had Essentials, but then they had... Before their epics, there was another line that they had. Right. And I almost can't think of what the name of it was, but, you know, they all, like, most of them had a black spine and said Marvel at the top and were white, but then sometimes they changed them to red. But, it's not quite an epic collection, but it is a bigger size trade.
Mm. Well, it came out a while ago, maybe 4 years ago, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And... You know, it's a thick trade, you know, collecting quite a bit of stuff. So pick that up. I don't think it's too expensive, though. And, of course, you can also find this in the Doctor Strange Masterworks series, which is how I'm reading it. I was just too lazy to get my, original issue out from the long boxes, Billy, this time around. Plus, you know, I'm scared that I would damage it because this is very precious comics for me. You're probably the same, but I think you've got a little bit more space in your house. So,
yeah, I have a lot of singles just laying around here in boxes all over the place because I do have a little bit extra space downstairs here. So until, you know, my wife really goes ape and threatens to like divorce me or something, I'm just going to have comics everywhere down here on this side of the downstairs. The other side I keep clean and keep my stuff away from there, but the side with the desk and comics and trades, that's, I kind of feel like, you know, leave me alone.
So basically it's easy. It's within hand's reach. That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now mine's, I need to walk down a couple of floors to get to mine, but you know, I could have done it. But this is Doctor Strange Masterworks Volume 5 for those who want to read along in the Masterworks. And that's those are the different places you can find this issue, listeners. All right, so to continue with our, you know, synopsis here, I'm going to start, Billy, and this is going to be another short one, listeners, because we don't want to give too much away. Much like the previous episode, which was episode 16, we had a very short synopsis. Simply because there's stuff that we don't want to spoil for those who don't know what's happening. I know there's a couple of listeners out there who follow along on our blog, right, Billy? So they kind of go image by image, and then I don't want to spoil this for them.
Yeah.
All right, here we go with the synopsis. After confronting the evil cosmic entity Shuma-Gorath, spewing from the brow of the comatose Ancient One in the crypts of Ka'u, Dr. Stephen Strange engages in battle against a force that he cannot hope to prevail against, mano a mano. After a lengthy diatribe, Shuma-Gorath reveals that he has burrowed himself in like a telepathic tick and is feeding on the mind of Stephen's mentor, relishing every savory neuron. This mental feast will eventually give him the power to fully emerge from the Cancerverse and conquer our reality. Shuma's parasitic nature is what prompted the wizened old sorcerer to attempt death by starvation, and Stephen comes to realize that once his master's mystic energies have been consumed, Shuma-Gorath will come into his full power. Seeking to delay this process, Stephen shifts battlegrounds, and an epic sorceress smackdown ensues within the mind of the Ancient One, ultimately ending in tragedy. And that's it for the synopsis. All right, Billy, as we're wont to do, let's discuss the cover first. What do you think about this, dare I say, arresting cover?
We'll be back after a quick break.
It's time to take a ride down the audiobook trail.
I am John McClane. Welcome to the podcast. I ended up discovering the world of audiobooks and thinking, you know what? I've found my spot. We'll do bloopers because I have thousands of them. I love a good story. And, you know, I have to admit, As far as vocations go, this one's pretty cool.
This is the Audiobook Trail Podcast.
We're going to drop a 30-minute episode every 2 weeks. Audiobooktrail.com.
It's definitely one of my favorites. Brunner has, he had a short lifespan at Marvel and in comics, really, if you look at it. And his, you know, work rate, because a lot of his work was so detailed and, you know, intricate, his work rate, you know, was not huge for the comic business, just because, you know, it would take him a while to get a cover and a whole interior book out. But this is definitely one of my favorites he's ever done. You have Doctor Strange blasting away with mystic bolts at some tentacles that are trying to grab him and kill him. And then in the background, you have the face of his mentor, the Ancient One. And it's kind of like a dichotomy where the left side looks like the Ancient One and the right side looks like evil Ancient One, like the Star Trek episode where it's evil Spock with the mustache goatee and good Spock without on the other one. It's kind of like a setup like that.
That's right. Yeah, this is the negative image of the Ancient One. Basically, we see that once we start reading the, you know, the story as it progresses. The way that Shumagorath appears at first is as the swirling fog that emanates from the Ancient One's forehead, and then that coalesces into a kind of a copy of the Ancient One, but a negative image. So brilliantly done. And then also the tentacles coming out from the side of the negative Ancient One's head, right, Billy? Those are the tentacles that sort of foreshadow the true form of Shumagorath, which is going to be revealed to us later on. But look at the layout here, Billy. It's a masterpiece of design, because you've got Steven on the left side, Shumagorath's tentacles on the right side, and then you've got the Ancient One observing the battle in an astral kind of form. And then you've got this vast cosmic expanse as a background. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful to look at. And it's definitely not the cosmos we're used to. This is some alien, well, it could be the Cancerverse where Shumagorath hails from.
Yeah, so, that's what I would think, yeah.
Yeah. So this is a great cover. And again, they use the 1970s trope of, you know, having dialogue on the cover, which is something that later I came to despise. But here I kind of like it, because since the Ancient One's face is split into two images, right? The good Ancient One, the left side, which is weird. Normally people associate the left side with evil, right? But that's just a superstition, a traditional superstition. But here the left side is the good side. He says, "Destroy him, my son. Destroy the devil god called Shumagorath." And then, Billy, what does the right side say? This is ridiculous. This is cool.
"Don't be a fool, Strange. If you kill me, the Ancient One dies."
Now, this is actually not true, if you think about it, Billy. This makes me think that Roy Thomas, the editor, might have had something to do with this cover, because if you read the story, the opposite is true, actually. So we'll find out as we progress through the tale. But basically, it's right from the get-go, we realize it's impossible for Stephen Strange to kill Shumagorath. You know, it's like an ant trying to you know, bring down a mastodon or something like that. I don't know who you put this cover blurb on. It's just, you know, not true. So don't believe that, readers, what you've just heard. All right, but we'll find out what happens during the course of the discussion of the story. So, Billy, now, okay, let's go to another piece of brilliant art. The first opening splash page, page one. Wow, this page just blew me away. It is so, I don't know how to describe it. Intricate is one word that comes to mind. Obviously, we have to sing the praise of the colorist as well, which in this case, I think, is Krusty Bunkers, or at least the inks were done by Krusty Bunkers. I'm not sure. John Constanza. No. Frank Brunner did the color.
Brunner did the colors. Yeah, you're right. The boxes up top say, and that's something that people, I don't know if they realize that or not either, but, you know, Steve and Frank, it says author and under Engelhart, and then co-creators under both their names, and says artist under Brunner's name, because they would get together and talk about what they were going to do. So it was definitely, you know, co-plotted by both of those guys. It was definitely, you know, something that not one guy or the other could claim, you know, 100%.
Yeah,
for sure.
Definitely. So pretty nice of Steve to also do that. But like you say, it is justified because both of them had creative insight into the story, the plot. Mm-hmm. And of course, Brunner was all about the art, but with some direction from Engelhardt as well. So this was a complete collaboration between the two. You're right. I've read that multiple times in interviews, you know, with Steve Engelhardt, and also not a lot of Frank Brunner interviews out there. But, you know, when you read back Issue Magazine and stuff like that, and they talk about this run, which is, face it, listeners, a seminal run. It's definitely some the comics that influenced a whole generation of writers and artists here. Most notably, we'll get to that later, but I can name drop someone here, John Totleben and Steve Bissett, you know, from Swamp Thing fame in the early 80s Alan Moore. They were influenced by this art and this storyline. You can definitely see some, you know, Frank Brunner's art definitely looks like John Totleben in some cases. You know, check out page 3, right, Billy, later on when you see Steven, you know, being buried alive in this kind of grave. That's definitely reminiscent of Swamp Thing art. So, you know, lots of people were influenced by this story.
Yeah, and then for anybody, too, that isn't familiar with, you know, work from back in this era, inks by the Singing Sons of the Krusty Bunkers. And, you know, when I first read that, I didn't know what the heck that meant either. But, you know, there were people that had their own, like, shops almost.
Yeah.
So Neil Adams and Dick Giordano had a New York City-based, like, studio basically called Continuity Comics or Continuity Studios.
That's right.
And a lot of people got their start there in comics. You know, they'd bring in new young talent that was, you know, itching to get a job, and, you know, hey, oh, something has to be inked, you know, and Marvel would say, oh, we need this story inked by Monday, and they'd have these guys go at it. And that's where you get the Krusty Bunkers from, or the Goon Squad they were called.
The Goon Squad.
But I mean, you had such a, like, some of the people that work there. I mean, this is just a couple of them. Vicente Alcazar, Terry Austin, Pat Broderick, Frank Brunner, obviously, Howard Chaykin, Dave Cockrum, Larry Hama, Dan Green. Like, it's just, you can go and look, you know, there's probably at least 30 names of people that at one point in time, maybe 40, that worked there, you know? So that's what that means. Because I know when I first got this, when I was a bit younger, I thought, what the heck does that mean? Who the heck inked this thing? Yeah, it's like, what is a Krusty Bunker? Because let's be honest, if you heard that and read that before the age of the internet, how in the world were you going to find out what that even meant? You know, good luck.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the thing is, you kind of had to rely on fanzines back then to find out, you know, what the Krusty Bunkers were.
Yeah.
I just know that they always showed up on, especially on the Marvel black and white titles, you know, stuff like the magazines, Dracula Lives and Monsters Unleashed. They also did some work for DC, I think the Sword of Sorcery series they did. But, you know, since we collected these comics, right, Billy, because this is some of our favorite stuff from the Bronze Age, we saw them, but not a lot of other people did. Like, if were into a superhero reading in the 1970s, other than Stephen Strange, you wouldn't see them on a lot of superhero comics for some strange reason. But they did some Red Sonja as well, I think, and some, you know, maybe some Conan. I'm not sure about that, but I remember seeing them quite a lot on the titles that I picked up, you know. So definitely ubiquitous, at least, you know, regarding the comics that I was reading at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just mind-blowing. Marshall Rogers, Joe Rubinstein, Bob Wyachek, Alan Weiss, Bernie Wrightson.
Holy,
I mean, Esteban Maroto, Bob Cloud. It's just, it is a who's who of artists. Gray Morrow. I mean, come on.
Whoa.
Who's who of artists from the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
That's amazing. No. Yeah. Really, really good. So, you know, that's a bit of a comic book history there for you listeners. The Krusty Bunkers. Neil Adams's Continuity Studios with Dick Giordano in tow. So brilliant splash page. I'd say we'd both agree. It's incredible. And takes my breath away just looking at it. You've got the Ancient One sprawling on the ground. You've got Shuma Gorath emanating from his head. And then you've got Steven looking shocked and surprised, but also getting ready to get into a magic pose to cast some serious spells here. And the way that Shumagorath written, you know, the title of the story, Finally Shumagorath, well done to John Constanzo, did the lettering on that, right, Stephen? It's got some, right, Billy? It's got some kind of a, I don't know, some Eastern influence, some mystical Indian, you know, kind of influence to the way it's being written. Right, I don't know quite how to describe it. It's amazing. So well done there, John Constanza. Everybody did a great job on that splash page. Mm-hmm. So, Billy, then we get into the comic. Now we see Shumagorath going into his typical villain monologue, which just quickly gives you a recap, I think, for readers, too. He tells of how he's been plotting his coming and how he's manipulated Stephen Strange and the Ancient One, and why the Ancient One couldn't help Stephen out during his recent trials with the servants of Shumagorath, like the Shambler from the Sea and Dagoth. So we covered that in our last Stephen Strange episode. But mm-hmm. then, you know, Stephen's ready to get it on. He's ready to commence battle because he thinks that the reason why the Ancient One stopped helping him is because he had full confidence that Stephen could defeat Shumagorath. That's what he thinks at first, mm-hmm. which is so not the case. So then Shumagorath sort of shows him just a smattering of his true power. He immediately seizes the mind of Stephen Strange and sort of plunges him into this kind of nightmare world where he at first buries him alive. Now, Billy, isn't that reminiscent of some John Totleben art? Obviously, Totleben came a decade later, but he was definitely influenced here by Brenner. Because you see these nightmare images of Stephen sinking into the ground and he's buried alive. Mm-hmm. And then Shumagorath sort of teases the times to come once he rules the world. He says that he's not only going to kill Stephen Strange, he's going to wipe his memory from the minds of his friends and from the entire world. Everybody will forget about him. And then... evil shall be worshipped as the primary religion. And you've got these scenes of these devil priests rallying people around them and crosses burning and pentagrams slammed onto the faces of buildings. And then you've got these two giant hands, which in fact Shumagorath doesn't have, sort of sucking, putting these little pebbles, which turns out to be planets, into this giant black hole. And Stephen Strange is just comatose in the background. Mm-hmm. I find that page, I think it's page 3 or page 4, I found it fascinating. It's like a sign of the times to come.
Yeah, it's funny too when Shumagorath says about, you know, he's going to erase Strange from the memory and all this jazz. And like you said, he said people will worship evil and supplant all other religion. And then he says, the people shall flock to me. But then when it shows the people flocking, there's this evil priest-looking guy, and in the background, there's a statue, but it's not a statue of Shumagorath. It's like, it almost looks like the living Buddha with horns.
Exactly. Exactly. It's probably, you know, I don't know what that signifies other than the fact, I mean, because you've got a pentagram there that's associated with witchcraft or Satanism too on the building there. So it could mean that... You know, he's just using all of... Because we know Shumagorath likes to work through intermediaries, right? So it could be that mm-hmm. he's using these idols as disciples. You know, because different people, obviously different religions all over the world, different cultures might worship different icons or different idols. So maybe, I don't know what that signifies, other than the fact that all evil is basically just an offshoot of Shumagorath. All evil cults and religions. That's what it says to me. So, but then he goes on to say, Earth shall be but the initial step in his conquest of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. So the reason for that, listeners, is we always wonder, like, why, especially in the DC universe, Billy, I'm always wondering, like, why does Earth always have to be the focal point of all cosmic evil or of all, you know, would-be... galactic conquerors, you know, they always focus on Earth first. Yeah, now, in this case, it makes sense to me because the only way that that Shumagorath can gain egress to the physical realm, to our reality is to, you know, enter through the mind of the Ancient One. Mm-hmm. Because only the Ancient One has sufficient power to fuel Shumagorath's coming, to fuel his entry into our world. So that makes sense to me. And now in the new Doctor Strange stories, we've realized that there are actually, in fact, many Ancient Ones, many, many Sorcerer Supremes all across the universe. But in this point in time in Marvel, this is it. Stephen Strange, or at least the Ancient One at this point in time, is the only Sorcerer Supreme in the entire universe, in the entire cosmos. Right. So, yeah, this is the only way that Shumagorath can, you know, get the power he needs, yeah, to open this doorway through the mind of the Ancient One. So he feeds on the Ancient One's magics. That's why the Ancient One starved himself. We mentioned that in the previous Doctor Strange episode. And that's why it's hard for Steven to defeat Shumagorath, because he's already so powerful. He's already, you know, entering into our world, right, Billy? It's the deed is done. That happened in the previous issue when the Ancient One was forced to expend his magic to save Steven from the demons of the Crypt of Ka'u. And that was part of Shumagorath's plan, to force the Ancient One to show his hand, as it were, to use his power to effect the change and to give him that final push through into our reality. So now it's been done. Steven's now facing something that he quickly realizes he cannot defeat. So we've got this brief mystic battle, Billy, and what happens?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't take long for the Doc to realize he's like kind of way short on power in matching up with Shumagorath. So as usual, he tries to use his brain, you know, once he realizes it's not going to happen if he just tries to use his, you know, his mystical and magical might. So he tries to, you know, pull a fast one on Shumagorath.
That's right. But wow, what a fast one it was, right, Billy? Because we've mentioned this in previous episodes. This is what I love about the Doc, and what I also love about characters like Batman and even people like Silver Age Superman, for instance. When they can't punch their way out of a situation or blast their way out of a problem, they resort to their intellect. And they use that to overcome a much more powerful foe in most cases. And this is certainly true of Batman, you know, but more so actually of Stephen Strange. Because if you think about the past, the foes that he's faced, all of them have been more powerful than him. Mm-hmm. Except for Mordo. I'd say. I mean, you have Nightmare, you have Dormammu, you have Umar, you know, you have the Living Tribunal, you have guys like that, you have Eternity. Now, some of those haven't always been enemies, but when they have been, Steven has managed to sort of best them or come out on top. Now, this is definitely the case with Shumagorath. Now, Billy, correct me if I'm wrong, this is arguably the most powerful foe Doctor Strange has ever faced up to this point in time, right?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, to me, like you said, there's been a lot of other, you know, entities, you know, opponents of the Docs shown to be very powerful, especially when they're in their realm, you know, in their backyard. Hmm. But, you know, Shumagorath is being shown as that he's, you know, no matter if he's in his realm or he's on Earth or wherever he wants to be, They don't come right out and say it, but you get the impression like he'd be able to best any of those other opponents Steven's already had to face, like, without a whole lot of problem.
Yeah, he even says that the Vishanti, Steven's patrons of power, if you want to put it like that, they are afraid of Shumagorath. They say the Vishanti don't concern themselves with Shumagorath. That's Shumagorath's actual words, right? Because, you know, they can't, their powers don't have any effect on Shumagorath, and in fact, they might fear him. So Stephen realizes that when his powers, which he calls up drawing from the Vishanti, is in fact negated by Shumagorath, by this eye blast. But then, listeners, we get to the part that you mentioned, Billy, the plan that Stephen Strange has, which is quite ingenious. He uses the Eye of Agamotto to draw all of his mystic energies within himself, and in fact shrinks. He becomes subatomic. And, you know, so it again displays how powerful Stephen Strange really is. He could, you know, easily copy the powers of, let's say, a guy like Henry Pym or DC's yep. The Atom. And here he shrinks to subatomic size, and then he, you know, flies into the mind of the Ancient One to escape Shumagorath, because he's figuring that Shumagorath won't destroy the source of his power to get to Stephen, mm-hmm. which is a smart move, because Shumagorath, in fact, he admits that, wow, this is a brilliant move on the part of Stephen Strange. He says, clever, he doth take our combat to my source of power. So, you know, but then he also says, yeah, Stephen will still die.
Uh-huh.
So why did Stephen Strange do this? He decided to try to find the answer, because since Shumagorath is emanating from the mind of the Ancient One, he thinks he might be able to find a way to shut Shumagorath down somewhere in the Ancient One's mind.
But right.
he discovers so much more, right, Billy?
Uh-huh.
While he traverses the Ancient One's brain. So there's this great panel where he's swimming alongside the Ancient One's thoughts. Isn't that an amazing panel, Billy, where these giant oval, colorful oval-shaped bubbles flow yeah. past him? They can only be neurons, I'm thinking.
They almost look like gemstones.
Yeah, like gemstones floating past Stephen. And then mm-hmm. he's flying through these canals of them. And then this is just part one of Stephen Strange's plan. Step one, right? Step two mm-hmm. is quite brilliant as well on the part of Stephen Strange. He creates a double of himself, right, Billy? Mm-hmm. A perfect double. But he uses the Ancient One's conception of Stephen Strange to create this double. So then he merges with this double of himself. Now, we'll see why later on. This is like a game of chess, of mental chess, which he's playing against Shumagorath here. This is the early stages of the game. And then Shumagorath approaches, and then he sort of buffets Stephen with these mind winds and twists reality around him. Now, Billy, you know the panel I'm talking about. When he encounters Shumagorath in the mind of the Ancient One, he's lashed by these bolts of lightning, and then Stephen's brain is all twisted. Now look at that panel where at the bottom left, Stephen, he's all distorted. Looks like a bizarro image of himself. That so looks like John Turtleman art.
Yeah, for real.
Even a little bit of Tom Yates, who did the earlier issues of Swamp Thing Volume 2. You've got this little branch with these eyeballs. He's falling through these spider web ringed trees. And then there's these branch with these eyeballs. Oh, my God, I can't stand it. Jeez, this tree with this eyeballs popping out of it. Ugh, yuck.
It's really creepy looking, yeah. And then it does look like something you would have seen in Swamp Thing 10 years later.
Definitely, man. There's lots mm-hmm. of... That's why I'm thinking those guys were inspired by Brunner. I mean, yeah. They had to be, in the art-wise at least. So then he encounters Dormammu, but it's just the thought projection of Dormammu. This is just Shumagorath playing cat and mouse with Stephen, right, Billy?
Yeah.
And then Dormammu sort of battles Stephen there for a while and trash talks him at first. And then our attention shifts to reality again, where the living Buddha, or as Stephen calls him, the corpulent one... He's being carried along by these little demons from the crypts of Kau, these green, you know, warty demons. And he's saying that, where is Shumagorath? They want to know, why hasn't he showed himself yet? And then they find the body of the Ancient One, but Stephen Strange and Shumagorath, you know, strangely absent. And one of the demons says, okay, well, he's going to put the Ancient One out of his misery.
Grant him the mercy of a swift end to his pain.
Yeah. But, you know, that doesn't make any sense. You'd think these demons would relish the fact that someone's suffering. But then it turns out that the living Buddha has got more smarts in his brain than fat. And he's saying, stand away. And we see an inkling of the living Buddha's power. He blasts these little demons with mystic bolts. And he says that, no, there's something wrong here. Something is amiss. Right? Shumagorath should have been here already. Somehow, yeah. Stephen Strange is delaying his coming. And until they find out how, they're going to leave matters be. You know, so they don't want to hurt the Ancient One or damage his brain because Shumagorath might be affected by that. Okay, so very interesting. And then Stephen sort of gets a grip on the situation because right now he's being tormented inside the mind of the Ancient One by all of these images of his old enemies. You've got Nightmare, you've got Dormammu. But then he realizes that, you know, Shumagorath is just using dream images against him. And once he realizes that, he sees that he can control his perception of the dream, right, Billy? So Stephen, in fact, then all illusions fade away, all nightmare images disappear, and he is confronted with the true image of Shumagorath. Now, this is my favorite panel, but also the most disturbing panel for me in the entire issue, Billy, where he sees Shumagorath for the very first time. Now, what did you think about that? That is, jeez, that's disturbing.
I love it. Because I don't know how to describe it. Like I said, Shumagorath has these tentacles, almost octopus-like, but this giant eye in the middle. But then when you look at what the eye and the tentacles are attached to, it almost looks like a giant floating brain or something, doesn't it? Like,
yeah,
it looks really scary and bizarre.
It does. No. It does. I mean, basically, his entire being is this mass of obscenity, as Stephen calls it, because it is obscene to look at. It's gross. It's slimy. It's dripping with some kind of ichor, right, Billy? And you know, then you've got this eye, but you know, it's almost like the Eye of Agamotto, because when the Eye of Agamotto leaves Stephen's amulet, you know, in the comics, this almost never happens. This never happened in the movie. You know, the eye stays put, and it's the time gem, blah blah blah. So that's fine. That makes sense in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I like that idea. But you know, basically in the comics, listeners, it for any new people new to Stephen Strange, but you know him from the MCU, it's not like that at all. The Eye of Agamotto is an actual eye, right? A mystical eye that can leave the amulet and do various things. It could serve as a remote, you know, observation mechanism. It could, you know, reveal hidden truths. It could dispel magics or illusions. And it could also give power to Stephen. But basically, it's an eye, right, Billy? And when the eye leaves the amulet, it freaks me out, man. I can't stand it. That little eye, and you can see the three-dimensionality of it. You know, the fact that it's peeling out of the lids. It's even got lids. The Eye of Agamotto's got lids.
It does. Yeah, it does. And sometimes it even deposits itself in the forehead of Stephen.
Oh, man, yeah, giving him a third eye, which is, you know, what mystics or psychics call the ability to see, you know, psychically. So, you know, that being the case, Shumagorath is much like the Eye of Agamotto, except grosser. Much, much more gross. Because what he is this giant, the underside of an octopus's body, but he's also this pulsating sack of brain matter attached to the eye. And, like I say, dripping with some kind of viscous fluid. And then he's got these purple tentacles, but the underside of the tentacles they don't have any suction pads, right, Billy? They're more like the underside of an earthworm's body.
Right. Yeah. Or just like, you know, they come out and grab you. That's it. There's not like suckers or like those, you know, some of them have those like almost like hooks on them and stuff like that.
Yeah. But this is more disturbing for me because.
Absolutely.
I mean, I once touched the bottom of a small crocodile's body. We went to a crocodile farm in South Africa as a kid, and you know, we were allowed to hold these small crocodiles, and they bind their mouths so they can't snap at you, and you know, then they take pictures, and it must be horrible for the crocodile, so I apologize to Mother Nature in general for that. But you know, I touched the bottom of that crocodile's stomach, and also the bottom of his tail. And it's a different feeling than the top, because the top is more rugged, more hard. It feels more, you know, like just an inanimate object. But the bottom is like a pulsating sack of life. Ah! God! You know the David Cronenberg movie The Brood? Mm-hmm. You know where the you know the story where this lady gives birth to these rage babies. she's got these egg sacs, pulsating membranous egg sacs attached to her body, and she gives birth to these children. And this is what Shuma Gorath reminds me of. Ugh.
Yeah, it's really disgusting looking, because like you said, like it almost looks like a brain with the tentacles and the eyeball, but then in between like all the crevices of this body or brain or he is whatever you want to call it, it looks like some kind of disgusting like juice or saliva or something in between all the cracks. It's disgusting looking.
Yeah, man.
Gosh.
Now that's why I love it.
Yeah, because it freaks me out. But that's a good page. Yeah, that's a great page top to bottom, because not only do you get, you know, a 2/3
Shuma Gorath,
Shuma Gorath, you know, coming after Steven, but then this is something that I love that you really didn't see with the previous creators, where it only stands to reason that if the Sorcerer Supreme is having some kind of perilous battle, that's like a cosmic scale battle, anybody else that's into magic and, you know, cosmic things like that, they would kind of get like a bit of a pulse from this and be like, hey, what's going on here? Like a cosmic awareness type thing, Captain Marvel has and stuff like that. So it shows, you know, a panel there at the bottom, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. They've got Baron Mordo, they've got Cleon Wong, and then Victoria Bentley, which is Steven's early love interest. You know, she was more like a student of his, right? But you know, Steven frequently does shack up with his students.
Yeah, he's got no real
compunctions.
His moral compass is pretty much dead.
Skewed. Yeah. Well, we'll see the universe getting revenge on Steven later on with old Ben Franklin coming into the mix.
I can't wait. Yeah, he'll learn.
Anyway, enough hints. The listeners are probably thinking, well, the listeners who haven't read ahead, they might think, what's up with this Ben Franklin mentions? But you'll see, listeners, it'll be worth it. Just wait for it.
Oh, it's worth the wait. Don't worry.
So, you know, Victoria and Clea and Wong and Baron Mordo, they're all feeling it. Now, this is something that I like, Billy. I always like it when there's an apocalyptic event that is so big that people from, you know, across the Marvel Universe senses it. They also used to do this in DC. You know, when something, let's say, terrible happens on the magical plane, you know, in a comic, like, let's say, for instance, Swamp Thing, then you've got, you know, folks like the Phantom Stranger or the Spectre or Dr. Fate, you know, also like being, you know, aware of it. And then that shows you the size of the portents, you know, being, presented to the reader here. It's that big a deal. So this is definitely the first time that has happened. And that shows me that Shuma Gorath is the most powerful threat Steven has ever faced. Mm-hmm. I just love the dialogue too, because Steven has now just dispelled the illusions that Shuma Gorath was sending against him to toy with him. And now he's confronted by Shuma Gorath in his actual form. And in the previous panel, Stephen Strange, my resistance to the mind of Shuma Gorath has ended my danger. Something like that. And then Shuma Gorath says, "Wrong, Strange. I am fully prepared to crush thee physically. Face my true form and die." And then we've got a classic Doc exclamation, right, Billy? What does he say?
Oh, one of our favorites, if not our favorite. By the hoary host of Hoggoth.
Yeah.
It's like he's crapping his pants.
Yeah. It kind of needs Steven's favorite exclamation for this most, you know, dangerous threat. And I that was also Stan Lee's favorite, you know, line that he ever wrote for Stephen Strange. By the hoary hosts of Hoggoth. So a great page. And like you said, great panels on that page. It almost warranted a whole page unto itself, you know, that image of Shuma Gorath, but they split it into four panels. Still great. And then we've got a couple of panels of Steven being manhandled here by the tentacles of Shumagorath. Now, our listeners, remember earlier we mentioned that Steven had a plan and he was playing chess with Shumagorath. Do you remember he created that double? That exact duplicate that he then merged with? Now, this is where Steven's intellect comes to the fore, I believe. This is now, Shumagorath is now trying to checkmate Steven, not realizing that Steven's got like a plan that's going to, in fact, turn the tables on old Shuma. So Steven abandons his duplicate body, which he merged with, remember? And he does so as an invisible wraith, or he cloaks his body's true form in invisibility. And then he flees deeper into the mind of the Ancient One, right? But then you see this panel of Shumagorath annihilating Stephen Strange, you know, just annihilating his duplicate. And then Stephen becomes visible. But now he knows what he must do. Now, Billy, I'm going to let you run with this because, you know, I've been talking a lot. I want you to tell me, how did, you know, what's happening here? And this is a momentous event, listener. So just perk your ears up to this, what's going to happen here.
Right. Well, as you were saying, like, Steven leaves his double, and it literally takes Shumagorath 2 seconds to figure out what's going on. And he says, "Thou seekest to delude me, Strange? Thou art but a speck toying with a giant." And Steven flies away. And he says, "Even as I race away, he is close behind me. He has all the arrogance and cunning of a creature born for evil, coupled with the power of my mentor." And then he says, "The combination is invincible, and that is why I must kill the Ancient One." But then he figures out, he says, "The dilemma cannot be denied or ignored. I must truly choose the lesser of two evils. Now, though long established, mind defenses seek to hinder me. I have reached my ghastly goal." And it shows a panel that's almost like a hexagon or something shaped. It's very bizarre shaped panel, which is really cool. And it's Steven has found the Ancient One's ego, and it looks like a cube or a rectangle, like yellow, funky. It almost looks like a Starlin picture, to be honest with you, what you see in his Captain Marvel stuff. And it's like this pink energy swirling all around it with a yellow background. It looks like so crazy. It's like very out there. Then again, more proof that, you know, when they say, "Yeah, we were smoking some stuff," you know it when you're looking at this panel.
That's right. Well, I mean, this panel is very geometric. You know, normally I think about these, you know, artists from the Marvel Bronze Age who are smoking something as being more chaotic. But this is a panel that's been so well designed. But obviously the idea, Billy, was generated during a late night of Steve and Frank just sitting around in a smoke-filled room in a haze. But this is the Ancient One's ego, which is, like you said, presented in this cubic-like structure and with this purple or pink energy cascading from it. And this is Steven's goal all along. He calls it his ghastly goal. He's reached his ghastly goal, which sort of foreshadows what he has to do. But the panel just before that, he has to go through these defenses, these rings, which kind of look like the rings of Ragador almost, right? These spirals that sort of hinder him. And when he makes it through this defense in the Ancient One's mind, he gains access to the Ancient One's ego, this giant cube of white light with pink energy around it. And then the next page, we see Shumagorath being alarmed, right? This is just this panel of his eye, which is in shock with these weird frills. Now, Billy, look at that eye. That kind of looks like a human eye when you wake up in the morning and you've yet to wash your face and get rid of all the sleep and the vitreous humor, or whatever they call that kind of substance, which your eye, you know, secretes, or your, you know, which is secreted by the glands around your eye, right? Now, look at that. That looks like it's been congealed around this purple mass and with the eye within it. Oh, it's gross. And then this eye just, you know, somehow a voice emanates from this eye, right? We never see Shumagorath's mouth. He doesn't have a mouth. And he's alarmed. He says, "Strange, what art thou doing?" And then we see, you know, Steven's plan. Because Shumagorath, in fact, realizes his plan at this moment. He says, "To tamper with the primal forces at the core of the wizard's being may destroy us both." And then Steven just says, "Precisely." And then he's got a couple of brilliant lines. What does he go on to say then, Billy, as he plunges headlong into the Ancient One's ego, into this cube structure?
Yeah, apparently Shuma-Gorath, and like you said, it's a sleepy eye. It's like pre-coffee eye. But he never had the thought. It didn't occur to him that Stephen was willing to sacrifice himself, the Ancient One, both to kill Shuma-Gorath, if that's what it takes. So then he says, after he says precisely, and he says, "The universe will not miss a speck, nor will it miss a giant." And he dives into that cube. He plunges into the glowing cell, it says. And then we got a Captain Kirk line here, "Where no man has ever dreamed of going before."
Yes, yes, brilliant. Excellent, excellent. And then, you know, he sees, according to Stephen, he's hanging in this realm of darkness, which is now within the Ancient One's ego, and he sees a pinprick of molten light that defies the dark. I just love the prose that Engelhardt's using here. I'll talk more on that later. And then he flies closer to this pinprick of light, and he sees that it is the Ancient One's conception of self. Now, what that is within the light is the form of the Ancient One sitting, meditating, with his legs crossed. And Stephen says, he admires the Ancient One's conception of self. He says, "Though dying, he still maintains inner peace." And then Stephen's
even better.
Yeah, okay, now you got to say the next line. He kind of berates himself, seeing the Ancient One sitting here so tranquil, so undisturbed by what's happening on the outside. Now, what does he say, Billy?
"By the gods, how can I dare to snuff out such a man? How?" Such a man.
Man. No. Brilliant. And then he says, okay, but, you know, this is something that the Ancient One must have planned, because he says, "For the universe to live, you know, he has to choose the lesser of two evils." The greater being allowing the Ancient One to live and having Shuma-Gorath take over the world. The lesser evil being the murder of the Ancient One. So then, Billy, we have the next panel, which I have to tell you this, Billy, when I was a kid, I felt this, like, this invisible hand gripping my heart, or this invisible hand roaming around my chest when I read this, because I didn't expect this. I didn't know what I was reading. You know, I was like a kid who paged through to the back end of a comic when I was in the corner store, when I was at the spinner rack. I was the kind of kid who I would read or look through the comic at the, you know, in the corner store, a page through the first three pages, and I knew I was going to like it, and I immediately bought it. And then I would hold on to it until I get home so that I could savor every panel and get to the end, because I didn't want anything spoiled, even back then. Now, this, I don't know, can you remember how you felt when you read this the first time? Because this next page was so upsetting to me. What happens? Let's describe it to the listeners.
Well, Stephen just unleashes this all-out, you know, force bolt and blasts that visage of the Ancient One. And as he's doing that, it's also, you know, I don't want to say killing, because we know he doesn't kill Shuma-Gorath here. But it basically, I guess you'd say it's closing the door from, you know, the 616 universe to the Cancerverse, and like shunting him back to his universe, where he's like, no.
Well, he definitely gets his eyes, like, glowing. Yeah, he definitely gets his tentacle slammed in the door there, Billy, as it closes.
And his pus coming out of his eye. Oh, God.
Jeez.
Disgusting. Yeah, it's just awful. But, like, when I first read this, see, I was probably 8 to 10 years older when I read this. So I was already pretty jaded, that I felt like, okay, I think what's going to happen is he's zapping the Ancient One inside his mind there, and he's going to come out, and the Ancient One's going to be like in his death throes, but then he'll just call upon the Vishanti or something, and it'll repower the Ancient One, and the two of them will walk out of there, you know, arm in arm, chuckling about all of this.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, but this isn't the 90s. This is the 70s. So that's not what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I kind of knew this was it, because, I mean, Stephen says he saved my life so that I could end his, right? So I kind of thought, okay, this is happening. This is really the end. This is the death of the Ancient One. So, of course, you know, Billy, as a kid, as a comic book reader, you always hold out some kind of hope. Because the Ancient One is so tied into Stephen Strange's mythology. This is like if Luke Skywalker took a lightsaber to Yoda as Yoda was lying there in his bed. I don't know. I mean, obviously that's not what happened, but, you know, this is that level of you know, upsetting. This is how badly it affected me. So, I mean, look at the pain from the Ancient One. You've got the Ancient One's ego, which is this little old man sitting here meditating, being assaulted by Stephen's bolts of bedevilment. And then you've got him screaming, ah! And then in the background, there's the Ancient One's soul or his mind also screaming. There's a giant image in purple and blue where you see the Ancient One's withered face screaming in ultimate anguish, right? And then you've got a panel juxtaposed with this, where the Ancient One's being assaulted, but the second panel right, you know, across from this, where Shuma-Gorath is screaming, no! And his eyes being bombarded by the same kind of energy. And he's just slammed back to his own reality, the Cancerverse. Obviously in pain as well, but like you say, not destroyed. And yeah, Stephen has murdered his mentor. He's murdered the Ancient One. He was forced to kill him to save the world. So that turned everything on his head for me, Billy. Because so this is part of Stephen's mythology. Ever since his very first appearance, the Ancient One has always been there. And he's gone. But in fact, we'll learn later, not gone for good. So Stephen then laments the passing of the Ancient One. And then we see that it was only Shuma-Gorath's power that was holding up this, these crypts of Ka'u, strangely enough. And then, you know, we have this, these panels of Stephen sadly leaving the crypts and, you know, lamenting the fact that he's a murderer. And he's already thinking that he broke his Hippocratic and mystical oath, you know. So he's already planning to quit as the sorcerer, as you know, a magician or a sorcerer. He doesn't know that at this point in time, he has in fact become the Sorcerer Supreme because of the passing of the Ancient One. He doesn't know that yet. So then we see, Billy, this great panel, but actually quite a horrible panel where the Crypts of Ka'u caves in. And of course, the little demons carrying this giant corpulent mass of the living Buddha on this little green platform made of jade, they can't make it out in time because they have to carry this weight, this burden, and they're crushed by the falling boulders, by millions of tons of rock. That's horrible.
Poor Buddha.
Yeah, and the Buddha's crushed. Oh, man. And it's a great bit of exposition there. They say that from every part of the crypts of Ka'u, a rumbling grows, becoming a shifting, a sliding, a roar. The dank stone dies with its master, and its heavily laden lackeys die with theirs. Oh, dude. They should have chosen a better profession.
The poor corpulent one.
Yeah, damn. I miss him. The golden Buddha.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So then Stephen, he takes no note of this. He just walks, takes his time, walks out of the crypts. The rocks barely miss crushing him. And he says, I promised the Ancient One I would never renounce my mystic powers, yet no assassin should wield such knowledge. And so he sees himself as an assassin, as a murderer. But then, Billy, what happens? He's sort of, his sacrifice or him sacrificing his mentor is sort of validated by the next few pages.
You get, this is a huge callback, and that's going to be, you know, brilliance for me when we get to that segment. Just, you get a callback where, if you remember, I think it was Marvel Premiere 3 that you and Grant did, where the Ancient One, I don't know if he's there or not, but I know the Doc's there, and there's a face inside a tree, and I think it's Nightmare, isn't it, that speaks to him?
Yeah, that's where...
I'm pretty sure.
You're right, that is where Nightmare sort of... prophesizes the coming of Shuma-Gorath.
They basically come right out and tell you that there's going to be many trials for the Doc, but there's somebody behind, a puppeteer behind the string, you know, behind the scenes pulling the strings of all this. It's not really just Nightmare, and you know, but this time it's not a nightmare, it's the Ancient One, and he's in a tree, then he's in the water, then he's in the stone of a mountain. He's basically everywhere, and then, you know, he lets the Doc know that, you know, now he's, you know, him, his physical body died, but his, you know, his spirit, or whatever you want to say, is one with the cosmos now.
That's right. Yeah, Billy, you're right. That's a great callback, because as you remember, that was the very first time that Stephen got the warning from Nightmare. And, you know, that I think that was the Barry Windsor Smith issue, wasn't it?
Yep, absolutely.
And, you know, that's also where he got the prophecy, the weird prophecy that was at that point in time written by Stan Lee. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think, how did it go? It's something like this: his secret is his power, his power is his secret.
His power is his secret, yep.
Yeah, so at that point in time, it didn't really make sense. But now, Engelhart and Brunner, they've kind of made it make sense, because his secret, the secret of Shumagorath, is that he was in the mind of the Ancient One, you know, and Stephen had to sort of discover that slowly through the course of many issues. And then once he discovered that, he realized that, you know, his power, if he knows the secret of Shumagorath's power, then he could defeat him.
Right.
And the secret being that, you know, you have to sever the source of his power, which is the life of the Ancient One. So right. From that weird prophecy that Stan must have just, you know, come up with on the fly, I don't know. Engelhart and Brunner sort of made it make sense and gave us a coherent narrative from that.
Yeah, there's callbacks out the wazoo in this one. And then the very final, you know, the Shumagorath is gone, and the Ancient One basically tells Stephen that, you know, I'm one with the universe, and I have, you know, other, what does he say? I have other matters to concern me now than, you know, Stephen kind of whining that his mentor is dead. And then he basically says that he's, what does it say? The death of Shumagorath released my magical powers. I bequeath them to you, O pupil. Use all your strengths well. Unknowing mankind will depend on you, and you must never fail them. So, yeah, a good ending, but yeah, you know, like I said, it sucks that the Ancient Ones, you know, more or less, he's kind of dead, but, you know, he's going to pull a Yoda here. I think George Lucas was reading some comic books back in his day, because, you know, all those Jedi die, and then their spirits are one with the Force, and it's like, yeah. Yeah, he was poaching stuff left and right.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, obviously, there's no single thing that you can use to pinpoint, you know, what might have influenced what. But, you know, for a while there, I mean, there's lots of things you could, you know, interpret when it comes to where they got this from. Now, look at this one panel, Billy. Like, the Ancient One appears as a tree, and that looks similar to the Celtic mythology god, the Dagda. You know, it's like a wood god, you know, that comes out of the tree. Yeah. Then you have him as a river spirit, which is reminiscent of Japanese and Chinese mythology. You know, they believe in Oni, you know, which, well, the Japanese at least do. And the Chinese believe in the river dragons, river spirits. And then you have this, him as this rock formation, you know, which is probably reminiscent of just, you know, Gaia, Mother Earth. And then, you know, now look at this. Okay, you have him as a spider. A spider with the Ancient One's face. Now, okay, that's reminiscent of the African god Anansi, right? The spider god. Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Billy, where have you seen these spiders with these faces before? I would direct your attention to Swamp Thing Volume 2. Marty Pascoe and Thomas Yates, when Anton Arcane, you know, Swamp Thing's villain, big bad, he came back from the dead many times, but in one time he came back in the form of this giant spider. With his face, with his torso even. Now, that's why I'm saying, you know, and Todelbin did some of those issues already. You know, it came from the minds of Pascoe and Yates, but then Todelbin ran with it, him and Steve Bissett, just before Alan Moore came. Yeah. I think it was Swamp Thing Volume 2, issues 18 and 19. And then you had Swamp Thing battling Anton Arcane in the form of the spider with his face. And this, the Ancient One looks like that. Now, I'm saying, look at all these panels reminiscent of the later art of John Turtleben and Steve Bissett. This is they definitely drew inspiration from Brunner, I'm thinking.
For sure. Absolutely. They had to have. Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of these guys were friends or friends of friends. So they were very aware of, you know, what was going on in the industry, whether you were at one company or another. And you figure it was still sort of a small community, basically based in New York at that time. Both companies were there with their corporate offices, and pretty much all the creators lived New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, in that area as well. Right. So they were around each other all the time.
Exactly. Yeah, no, I agree. They were, like we said, we spoke about this before, like sort of a type of osmosis happened. You know, that's what mm-hmm. caused people to sometimes come up with the same ideas. You know, you had like Doom Patrol, X-Men, you know, running at the same time in the 60s. And then you had stuff like the Heap, Man-Thing, Swamp Thing, you know, coinciding. The creation of those, well, not the creation of the Heap, but the resurgence of the Heap in Skywald, and then Swamp yeah. Thing coming up in House of Secrets, and then obviously running concurrently with Man-Thing that came just before that. So, you know, lots of right. people were not sharing ideas consciously, but, you know, through meeting up and talking and the similar things that they were reading and similar influences. I don't say this is plagiarism. I just say this is a sign of the times.
Yeah.
You know, what that they yeah. were living in and discussing and reading. So, you know, this is definitely, like you say, it could be the reason. But it's so direct almost, you know, believe that I can't believe that it couldn't be, you know, the single most thing that inspired Totalbin and Bissett. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it could be.
Yeah, but there must have been many others. I mean, this is just my own opinion, listeners. I'm just speculating here. But then, Billy, we have these, like this whole issue has been filled with brilliant prose, with mm-hmm. great writing on the part of Engelhardt. The issue ends with the Ancient One, you know, heading from the spider into a cloud form, and then heading from a cloud form into the, like, vines or moss on a wall. I'm not quite sure what that is. But then the yeah. final form is him becoming one with the cosmos, and his face has become... well, a part of the firmament. And then yeah. he speaks and he says that, you know, you are now the Sorcerer Supreme. Use your strengths well to defend mankind. And then we have this wonderful little caption box, mm-hmm. you know, finishing off the issue saying, "Then the sky breathes a soft farewell, and amid a quickening wind, Stephen Strange stands alone." Mm-hmm. And then that's the brilliant. End of the issue. Oh, man. That's
yeah,
so...
brilliant panel. Oh,
really, really good. So why is this issue so seminal? For one, Stephen Strange murders his own mentor. But it mm-hmm. just when you think this is something he would never recover from, it's reprehensible. The Ancient One, in fact, tells him, "No, you set me free." Mm-hmm. You know, and then the third most important thing of this issue is the fact that Stephen Strange is now more powerful than ever. He has now become the Sorcerer Supreme. And with that comes new responsibilities, new dangers, new enemies, and like we mentioned, new abilities, right? But which will be explored by Brunner and Engelhardt in subsequent issues.
So yeah, you figure that's a brilliant thing to do, because then you can take that anywhere. You know, you exactly. really have the keys of the kingdom to do whatever you want with this character. And they really, like you and I have said before, this is the golden age of Doctor Strange, and not golden age as in, you know, comic book timeline, but this is the greatest heights he ever reached with these guys creating him and, you know, penciling and inking and writing him. It's just out of this world.
Yeah, yeah. Now, not to take away anything from Gene Colan and Engelhardt when they finally got on the Doctor Strange title proper, but, you know, there were seminal storylines in that too. But the game changer had already been effected. It had already happened. Yeah. The fact that, you know, the big change. It's sort of like, you know, again, I keep comparing it to the Alan Moore run. But, you know, when Alan Moore introduced, you know, his new Swamp Thing in the anatomy lesson, where we learned that Swamp Thing was not, in fact, Alec Holland, blah, blah, blah. You know, that the yeah. whole story ran from that point and then expanded into something else. But it never really eclipsed that single event. I mean, there's lots of other mind-blowing things that happened during the run, but,
sure.
but everything sort of flowed out from that one decision that Moore made to yeah. kind of flip everything, flip the tables. And this is what will happen from now on with Dr. Stephen Strange. And Engelhardt will be at the forefront of this until he finished writing the title, and then, you know, other folks took over, Claremont and then eventually Stern. And they didn't run with that, but they sort of kept that status quo for a while. You know, and then told great yeah. stories, because Engelhardt and Brunner set the stage for mm-hmm. wonderful Stephen Strange stories to come. And this is also the most successful that the comic has ever been up to this point, right, Billy?
Right.
Because it was in Strange Tales, it was not that successful, and then was cancelled, and then Doctor Strange Volume 1, again, not that successful. They tried different things, cancelled, and then it came back in Marvel Premiere, and then suddenly people started taking notice. Mm-hmm. They took notice in the 60s too, of course, because it was such an interesting character, so way out there, but eventually, the hype faded. But now Strange is back in prominence, and I would say he was one of the best-selling titles. I mean, this is not hearsay. This is actually based on the numbers of the time, which you can find in places like the back issues and, magazines and stuff. Mm-hmm. It was selling through the roof,
Yeah, it was. It was really, and honestly, the only thing stopping this from being a much longer run of brilliance was the fact that they wanted the new Doctor Strange title that starts out, we have a few more issues of Marvel Premiere and then it spins into its own series, but it went into its own series and they wanted it to be a monthly comic because it was selling so well. Why not have it be monthly? But like we said earlier, Frank Brunner's artwork, it's just so good and so intricate, and his way of work is just, it's not compatible with a monthly comic. Every other month was okay, but a monthly comic for him was very tough to get out every 4 weeks. So that was him not being able to keep that schedule in a comic book. That was the only thing stopping this for, like, I'd feel like Engelhart and Brunner would have went on for 10, 15, 20 more issues. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Now, what we got out of that, though, is Gene Colan's art. So, definitely not a detriment But like you say, it could have gone on longer. And I would have loved that because Brunner is my favorite Doctor Strange artist, whereas Colan is my favorite Marvel artist, as a whole, for everything he's done, especially the stuff on Doctor Strange and Tomb of Dracula. But, point being, I think Brunner is just born to draw Doctor Strange. Not just the Doc himself, but his supporting cast, his, ethereal realms, his universe, yes.
And that's the thing, too. There's really some solid stuff after Brunner, too. Not to, take push away. That down. Mm. Yeah, not to take away from that at all. But once Brunner left, it wasn't a collaboration anymore. It was just Engelhart was writing the scripts all by himself. Then Colan would do the artwork. It wasn't like, when they go out and have dinner and eat a few mushrooms or whatever and get crazy and create this mind-blowing stuff. It was just Engelhart would write a script and he would send a full script to Gene Colan and Gene Colan would draw it. And again, great artist. He's my favorite artist of all time, Gene Colan. Like you're saying, he's no slouch, but it just wasn't, there wasn't that synergy there anymore. Like there was when Engelhart and Brunner were like co-collaborators, collaborating on the stories and artwork and everything together.
That's right. That's right, Billy. Now, listeners, we got to mention, Billy, you and I talked about this off mic. The Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Misstep section is going to be very short. So I'm not going to have a break between the main discussion and that because this issue is near perfect. I would say it's a perfect issue for me. It doesn't showcase much of Doctor Strange's supporting cast. I mean, you have a brief single panel of Cleon Wong, and that's it. And Victoria Bentley, even though she wasn't part of the cast at this point in time. It's just got Doctor Strange and the Ancient One, and then the enemy, Shuma-Gorath, and then, of course, Shuma-Gorath's lackeys. But because it's just action from beginning to end, and it's this feeling of everything's fraught. Everything is... you're playing for high stakes here. It's sort of like a breakneck pace that the comic runs at this point in time. Don't you agree, Billy?
Yeah.
So the entire issue gives you this feeling of terror. I really felt like, okay, this is something bad. It's leading up to something bad. Something terrible is going to happen. Strange might die. I don't know. I wasn't sure at the time that I was first reading it, but I remember feeling really anxious when I read this comic as a kid. And I still do when I reread it, which I've done hundreds of times by now. So I'm going to go first, Billy, and I'm going to say Bronze Age Brilliance. okay, I'm again going to focus on one thing, but I'm going to have some honorable mentions. Let me go with the honorable mentions first. The art. Mm-hmm. The art is definitely a standout here. The dialogue, the prose, it's amazing. I mean, I'll cite some... One example of the art we've already mentioned, the opening splash page and the reveal of Shuma-Gorath being my two favorite images. And then the nightmare scenes where Steven's being tormented is all brilliant. And the prose, though, is just as great. We've mentioned the final send-off on the very last panel of the issue. But then there's some other parts where, you know, like the brief interlude where we see Stephen being menaced by the nightmare images, and then they cut to reality where the living Buddha is walking around. Engelhardt inserts this caption box, and in it he says, "Meanwhile, outside the cranial combat zone, the corpulent lord of the crypts of Kau and Shumagorath's loyal disciple approaches." You know, he's got all these, you know, okay, that's a lot of alliteration there. You know, Stanley would be proud. But, you know, you've always also got this these great descriptions. And, you know, when Stephen uses his magics, you do need him to have some exposition. Otherwise, you wouldn't know what he's been doing. Like, suddenly he creates a double of himself. If you don't, if you're not privy to his thoughts, right, Billy, you won't understand. Right. So this is the kind of comic where you need that. Now, I know people say modern comics, they should show, not tell. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, you need some great prose. And comics are good for that. So a little bit of exposition is sometimes good.
Yeah, comics nowadays aren't intricate enough, or as they were in a book like this. So you can do that. You can have very limited dialogue, and you still know what's going on, because there's way more splash pages and kicking and punching and action scenes where you know what's going on. It's very obvious what's going on. But when you're talking about comics in the Bronze Age, and then especially something with, you know, Doctor Strange and magical, mystical characters and things like that, you wouldn't know what's going on if you cut the, you know, the dialogue in half of what it is. You'd be lost.
That's right. That's exactly right, Billy. I mean, and then a final bit of dialogue that I want to cite as evidence of the beautiful prose is just after Stephen slaying the Ancient One, there's another caption box where Engelhardt says, "The twin screams." Now, this is the scream of Shumagorath and the Ancient One. As Stephen slew the Ancient One, Shumagorath was also denied his entry into the world. So he also screamed as the door was slammed onto his tentacles, like we mentioned. So the twin screams flay Stephen Strange's ears until the cries decay into echoes. Echoes that will haunt him forever. And echoes are but the ghosts of screams. Saying that these screams that of the Ancient One will haunt him forever like ghosts. Because they're echoes, and echoes are the ghosts of screams. That's just, that's lovely. That's beautiful. That's wondrous prose.
This is prose like you would find in a novel.
Exactly.
Not in a comic book. This is like in a novel. And I mean, I'm the same way for you too. For brilliance, to me, the biggest thing is all the callbacks all the way to the beginning of this in Marvel Premiere 3. But yeah, some of these, oh my gosh, like Engelhardt was so good. Like in the page where it shows, you know, Stephen's thinking, okay, I'm going to get ready to fight Shumagorath here, like way back on page 3. And then Shumagorath, you know, beats him to the punch and says, "When Shumagorath doth rule reality, my first act shall be to bury thee alive." And then it says, "And the mortal magician is suddenly seized with chest-crushing suffocation," when the doc, like, he's making him think he's being buried alive.
Yeah.
And Shumagorath says, "Thy dirt-filled mouth shall scream forever in hideous agony, I, even after thy death, because not even thy friends shall mourn thy passing. The memory of thy life and thy way shall be vanished from the mind of man."
Wow. Goose flesh. I've got goosebumps, man. No, it's crazy. There's no disputing the fact that this is, that Engelhardt was firing on all cylinders here. Maybe he had some delusions of grandeur, you know, like setting himself up to be this great, you know, literary writer, but I don't think so. I think he was just having fun. I think he was just enjoying himself, much like Roy Thomas did when he sort of attempted this kind of writing.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. I think that's just, it's just who fun. He is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well done, guys, on this issue, the entire creative team, but especially Brunner and, of course, Engelhardt. So, Billy, I mean, is there a Mighty Marvel misstep for you? There isn't much. I mentioned, like, the Bronze Age Brilliance. I had some honorable mentions that I just mentioned. My main, obviously, the main thing that I liked is the plot itself, you know, the way things unfolded, the way they set it up, the way it was exciting, but also it was a revelation, and it also was a shocking realization when you came to understand that he's going to kill the Ancient One. The way they set that up, the way they built up to that was quite amazing, and I can't fault anything other than the fact that they could have maybe delayed, you know, the realization that Stephen was going to kill the Ancient One, because Stephen already crawls through the mind of the Ancient One, and then he already tells us what he's going to do. You know, but that's a minor nitpick. It's not a big deal. You know, before he even reached the Ancient One's ego, he says, "I must kill the Ancient One," right? Just before he reaches the ego. So, yeah. But at that point in time, you're still wondering, is he going to go through with it? Probably not. Right?
Right. Yeah. You're thinking, I said, I was thinking, especially being, you know, very jaded at that point, thinking to myself, you know, seeing deaths and people coming, being reincarnated and all that kind of stuff that happened, you know, mid to late 80s through the 90s was like people, that was when the big boom of, oh, they're dead and they're coming back, you know, a year later or 2 years later or whatever. So I thought, oh, he's going to kill them. But, you know, they'll get out of it somehow. They won't kill off a character that's been around since, you know, Strange Tales 110. You know, yeah. They're not going to do that.
Exactly.
So that was still a bit of a shock, even though it was sad.
Exactly. So, you know, point being, listeners, we probably don't have any Mighty Marvel mistips this time around, because this issue is perfect in all, in every single sense of the word. It's perfect. What do you think, Billy?
Absolutely. Yeah, like I said, I've got nothing to nitpick here at all. There's just brilliance. There's, like you said, there's just so many things, and the callbacks are what was like, I kept reading and thinking, where did I hear that before? I'm like, oh yeah, 3-4 issues ago, you know, when they call him a cosmic obscenity. You know, they said about that in, it was issue 7 or...
Yeah, at
maybe
least.
It was issue 7 or 6, maybe as back as 5. I can't remember. It was quite, you know what, it might have even been the Archie Goodwin issue 4, where they called him a cosmic obscenity. And, you know, like you said, the whole part with Nightmare from the Barry Windsor Smith and Stan Lee issue, you know, his secret is his power and his power is his secret. It's, oh man, they really pulled out all the stops here. They brought so much Engelhart and Brunner into this new, but then they still called back to all the way back to the beginning of this, which is great. To me, that's what a great writer does.
Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of like a well-rounded story arc, because it ends where it began with, you know, the Ancient One inhabiting these different planes of reality. And then that's what happened when Stephen first learned of Shumagorath, with Nightmare doing the same. So it's like it began with evil, but ended with good. Mm-hmm. And Nightmare and the Ancient One being juxtaposed as harbingers of evil and good, playing off against each other. That part was really mind-boggling, and you know, I only realized this much later with many rereadings, right, Billy? And the first time that I read it, of course, it was all like, what? He killed the Ancient One? He killed his teacher? I wanted to kill a couple of teachers back then, but not my favorites. I wouldn't kill my favorite teacher, you know. I was like worshiping my favorite teachers back then. So yeah, disturbing. But Billy, this is one of the longest main segments we've had, because there's so much we wanted to say about this issue.
And, yeah, it was very good.
But we did fold Bronze Age Brilliance and Mighty Marvel Mistips into it, so understandable. But you know, there wasn't really much of it. So still, listeners, I hope you enjoyed our discussion of one of our favorite issues of Doctor Strange of all time, in fact. So, but there's more to come. There's definitely more goodness found in the pages of Marvel Premiere and in Doctor Strange's title, which will follow after this, you know, when it gets to Doctor Strange Volume 3, right, Billy? He's going to have his own title again based on the wonderful sales of Marvel Premiere. Well done to the creative team. Like I said earlier, you know, they really brought Stephen Strange back to prominence in the early 70s here.
Yep.
So Billy, then we're going to take a small break, and then when we get back, we'll talk about our regular segments. We'll discuss particularly our Shop Talk segment. So don't go away, listeners. Oh, and before I forget, check out the blog sinkintotheweird.com, where I'll be posting lovely images from this issue so that you can read along with us and enjoy it if you don't have the actual issue in front of you. Sinkintotheweird.com hopefully will give you what you need. But we'll be back in a jiffy, so yeah. Stay tuned to Into the Weird.
You looking at that couple inside?
Actually, I was just looking at this little pink number over here.
Oh yeah, that's kind of nice. They look happy, don't they?
What, the bras?
No, the couple. They look happy.
I guess, as far as couples go.
You know, it reminds me of an issue of Spider-Man I did when Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy went lingerie shopping. Of course, the Green Goblin showed up, and he pumpkin-bombed the hell out of the place. But aside from that, it's pretty much the same thing.
Oh, my God. Holy shit!
All right, listeners, we're back with Shop Talk, the segment where we almost complain, but not quite. Sometimes we just discuss what we've been reading lately or watching lately, or general things about Marvel that we like and dislike, but we're not going to go full off Get On My Lawn, Billy. We're almost going to do that with what we're going to be talking about. Grant and I recently appeared on DC OCD, you know, the podcast helmed by Paul Hicks from the Wedding for Doom podcast. Yeah. And we discussed comics and so forth. And I felt a little bit, I mean, it was a great episode. I loved appearing with Paul and with Grant again. And we talked about some interesting things. But, you know, afterwards, Paul and I and Grant, we started talking and Paul recommended some good series to us. And Paul still reads a lot of new comics. And in fact, lots of people do. Martin Gray, you know, from the Waiting for a Girl blog or what's the blog called? I always forget the name. Too Dangerous for a Girl. Waiting for
a Girl. Too Dangerous for a Girl.
Apologies, Martin. Too Dangerous for a Girl. These guys, you know, they're our age or maybe even a little bit older. They're still on the cusp of, you know, new comic releases. They're really good at following along with the trends and everything new. And they still follow what's happening and buy new comics. And I feel kind of bad because I don't, and I'm sort of disillusioned at the moment with new comic book releases. But you know, so Paul recommended some new series that I'm going to be checking out. So I might talk about them on future segments, and then I might read a little bit of new comics here and there again. Mm-hmm. I mean, never say never, right, Billy?
I still see stuff once in a while too that piques my interest, and I've been out of the new market for a lot longer than you. But every once in a while I see something like that. I see the covers for those, what's the name of that Hulk series? And it's like
The Immortal Hulk. Yeah.
Yeah, the covers look really crazy good. I'm thinking, oh man, I mean, I know it's not going to be Alex Ross interiors, but still it's like I almost want to buy them just because the covers are so cool.
Yeah. See, I do buy that series, but when I say buy that series, I don't buy it by issues, you know, I buy it in trades, you know. Okay. So I bought the first three trades and I've read them and I love them, and I've yet to buy the rest. But I do, in fact, I have read ahead digitally. You know, every now and then they have a sale on Comixology. I'll buy a few digital titles, but you know, it was months after those issues were published, so I was quite behind on it. But I've since read until issue 25, right, Billy? And cool. It's my favorite Hulk run ever. Wow, bar none. Cool. It's horror, Billy. Really, it's horror.
Yeah, that's what I heard, yeah.
But it's Al Ewing, you know, who cut his teeth on 2000 AD, way back when. Mm-hmm. So I know the guy because I used to read, I'm still reading lots of 2000 AD. Like, listeners, when I say I don't buy new comics, there are, of course, new comics I do buy. I'm a big 2000 AD guy. I get the weekly prog all the time, digitally, though. So, yeah. You know, I do read some new comics. Here and there, I collect some sporadic issues, new issues I'll buy. But, you know, basically the only thing that I'm keeping up to date with is 2000 AD. But, you know, Al Ewing comes from the British stable of writers and creators. And, wow, Billy, I would recommend that series to anybody. This is actually, I could have left this for the recommendations of Ragador, but our conversation spiraled into that. So, you know, listeners, expect us to sometimes we will talk about some new series out there, and we won't always vilify all the new comics there is. It's just at the moment, right, Billy, nothing really, really floats our boat. Not enough to buy the monthly issue. You know, that's
one to me is the only one. Other than that, I don't really see a whole lot that piques my interest, but that one has for a while now, and a lot of people in our Twitter circle have recommended it as well.
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of indie comics. You just have to listen to Jerry,
like
Professor
Jerry.
Frenzy. Yeah, Professor Frenzy. I love listening to that show with him and Chris because there's so many indie comics that I sort of like put in a notebook and say, I got to read this. When this is collected in trade, I want to read this. Mm-hmm. So I'm not picking up the singles, but I'm definitely going to pick up the trades once those story arcs are collected.
Yeah, I'm in the mood for a good horror story. So I'm going to start looking and listening to Jerry and start looking for a good indie horror book, because that's what I'm really looking for right now. If anything's going to get me to take a chance, it's a horror book, either the indies or if I can find those trades, like you're saying, of Immortal Hulk.
Yeah,
I can go for that. That's what's going to get me to take a chance on a new or newer title is a horror book.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of good series out there. I'm very happy because the horror sort of anthology comic has made a resurgence in the last year or so with titles like Edgar Allan Poe's Snifter of Terror. And then you've got Ice Cream Man as well, which is sort of horror anthology title from, I think it's from Image. And of course, Dark Horse is still going strong with their Hellboy universe.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a couple of good titles out there. But Jerry and Chris, they're good at pinpointing these series that you otherwise wouldn't have heard about. You know, right. Unless you're on Comixology every day or reading the previews every day or every week it comes out. You listen to Professor Frenzy, the Professor Frenzy show, listeners. I think most of you already do listen to them.
Yeah,
because they're great for discovering these indie titles. So we'll get back to that, Billy, once we find a series that we're really into, and we'll reserve that for our Shop Talk segment. But Billy, then other than appearing on the DC OCD cast, you know, where we talk the new 52, I realized something. That was the last time that I was sort of a frequent reader of monthly day and date releases. You know, I was budgeting a lot for my weekly stack of comics, and I realized that is the thing that kind of broke me, you know, because so many of those titles, maybe I would say 70% of the comics I bought during the New 52 and the stuff from Marvel at that time, they were very disappointing and they weren't worth the $2.99 that I was paying for them. And then, you know, it all adds up. And then after a while, I realized I have this stack of comics, which I don't want to reread. Right. And, but I paid like $40 for them. So, you know, that I eventually ended up just giving them away, you know, to the kids of friends or, you know, people around here that I wanted to get into comics, but they didn't get into comics. And, big surprise, because the stuff I was giving to them wasn't that good.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. So and anyway, but you know, during our previous episode, Billy, our Shop Talk segment was a little bit wonky because I sort of cobbled together a couple of segments that we had floating around from the past that I ended up not using, and then I eventually decided, okay, I'm going to use it. And, you know, we said we would sort of redo this Shop Talk segment that was lost due to technical difficulties. So we just want to let the listeners know, you know, two episodes back, we talked about movies, Black Widow and stuff like that, and movies we're excited about. And there's one movie that we discussed, and that was the movie that was sort of, you know, the discussion of which was giving me technical issues when I started editing the podcast, and that was the Wonder Woman 1984 movie, which is being released in June. Now, Billy, this is one of the few superhero movies I'm kind of going to watch, I think, because the reason being my daughter and my wife, they're big into Wonder Woman. But the one that I'm personally looking forward to the most would be Black Widow, because since the last time we spoke, you recommended the trailer to me. I did then go to see the trailer of the Black Widow movie, and it looks great. I mean, you've got the Red Guardian in there. You've got Black Widow's old, class of assassins going out on a mission in Russia.
Yeah.
David Harbour's the Red Guardian, right? David Harbour from Stranger Things. So it looks like a blast. I'm going to enjoy that. Like you said in the episode we did, the only criticism you can levy at the Black Widow movie is that they didn't make it when she was still alive in the MCU. But still, I'm looking forward to that movie. But let's get back to the Wonder Woman one. How do you feel about that? Are you going to go watch the Wonder Woman movie?
I'm going to wait and see.
Ah.
Closer to it. You know, they'll release more trailers and clips and stuff like that, and then I'll definitely wait to see, you know, if you go out to see it right away, you know, on opening week, you know, you guys see them on Wednesdays out there opening night.
Yeah, usually. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll wait to see somebody, you know, talk about it and say, you know, a little bit more of the particulars. See, I'm not huge. I don't have a huge volume of Wonder Woman knowledge or really DC stuff. So when they said who the villain was going to be for the movie, it didn't do anything for me. So I was just like, okay.
Yeah, well, it's Maxwell Lord and then the Cheetah maybe. Okay, the only thing is that if you do read DC and you do know the history between Wonder Woman and Maxwell Lord, then I hope it's not going to happen, you know, the way it happened in the comics, because basically I'm going to spoil something for you, Billy, since you're not going to read it, right?
Yeah, I'm not going to read that soon or at all. So go ahead.
Yeah, so listeners, for you who don't know, just you know, don't listen to this next part. Just skip ahead 30 seconds. Basically, she snaps Maxwell Lord's neck, you know, in the comics. She kills him. Wonder Woman kills Maxwell Lord.
Oh, I think I have heard that. You know, I think I did hear that.
So anyway, if they're going to go that way, you know, the Superman route, you know, like we saw in Superman Man of Steel, then I'm out. You know, I don't want that. I mean, the first Wonder Woman movie I enjoyed because, number one, I'm a big war buff. I like the World War One setting. And I like Gal Gadot. I think she's a vision. And I also like Chris Pine. You know, I thought he was a great Captain Kirk, even though I didn't like the Star Trek universe that he was in. I liked him as Captain Kirk, and I think he's a great actor. Not great, maybe a fine actor. And, you know, so I'm going to watch it with my wife and daughter. And then I watched the trailer. It's got good bits. It's got bad bits. But overall, interesting. So that's the only a movie other than Black Widow that I'm really excited about in the superhero cinematic scheme of things. But there's a couple of other good ones, Billy, that you and I have got to go and see. The Invisible Man being top of the list. A bit of horror there for you?
Yeah, like I said to you previously before we started recording, I know a couple of people that have some similar interests to you and I with, you know, Universal Films, Hammer Films and stuff like that, comics, have already been to see that and said it was very good. So I think I'm going to give that one a go.
Excellent. Awesome. So Billy, I think that's it. That's the only things I have to talk about for Shop Talk. I don't know if you have anything else you want to mention.
That's all, man. That's all I got.
Then we can head on straight into a bit of a promo that we're going to play from a show that everyone should definitely listen to. After the promo, we'll be back with our
recommendations of Ragador.
Ah, after a long day of criminal activity, there's nothing I like better than to sit down and listen to the old radio. Wait a minute, that's not a radio, it's
Plastic Man! Plastic Man! Plastic Man!
That's right, it's the Plasticast, a brand new podcast dedicated to Plastic Man. I'm your host, Max Romero. Together, we'll be talking about Plastic Man in the Golden Age, the Silver Age, the Bronze Age, and every other age you can think of, right up to his upcoming reappearance in DC Rebirth. We'll also be talking about any Plastic Man news that might be coming up, and his appearances in every media from comics to cartoons. Whew. Makes me woozy just to think about it. I hope you'll join me to talk about the longest arm of the law here on the Plasticast, here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Plastic Man! Plastic Man!
Okay, listeners, we're back with the
recommendations of Ragador.
As this is your brainchild, I'll let you go first. What do you have on the docket for us to read and to expose us to for this week's recommendation segment?
Okay, so just a few short weeks ago, I ended up grabbing a trade. I think it was 2015 Marvel released it. Monster of Frankenstein. So if you would like to read, you know, a good horror story that starts out with, you know, a story for, I think it's the first four issues that mirror the Mary Shelley Frankenstein story. This is for you because it was rendered by Mike Ploog, one of our favorite horror artists.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he's a good one. So you get that, the entire 18 issues of Monster of Frankenstein in this, and then you get some of the black and white magazine material, and then Giant Size Werewolf number 2, and then 2 issues of Marvel Team Up 36 and 37, which are hilarious, by the way, because it's a werewolf by night, Frankenstein kind of, and Spider-Man, and just nonsense ensues. You know, can you imagine a conversation between Frankenstein monster and Spider-Man? It's great.
Oh, that is glorious, really, really. One of my favorite trades, like I said, I, you know, much like Werewolf by Night, I wasn't reading Monster Frankenstein as it came out on the stands. I think it was already, you're done by the time I, you know, started collecting comics, you know, Baliso. I didn't pick it up in back issues until much later. But I bought the trade as well. It's a great trade. It's a nice little thick, you know, almost like the epic collections we mentioned earlier. You've got him versus Dracula in there. And like you say, you've got him interacting with other characters from the Marvel Universe. And then, of course, there's the heavy horror element. Even though hampered by the comic book code, you've still got these snippets of horror. And, of course, nobody beats Mike Ploog when it comes to drawing either a werewolf or a Frankenstein monster. The only person who comes close, of course, is Bernie Wrightson. You know, his Frankenstein can't be beat. But Mike Ploog is a very close second. Very close second. Sometimes I prefer him even more in some storylines, story arcs. I like his art even more than Bernie. But then most of the time, Bernie shines through very strongly. Still, wow, Billy, what a great recommendation. So, Monster of Frankenstein, collected edition from Marvel.
Yeah, the creators, I mean, Gary Friedrich, Doug Mensch, and Bill Mantlo writing, and the illustration, you know, like I said, Mike Ploog, then Big John Buscema, Bob Brown, Val Mayerick, and Don Perlin. So, I mean, you've got some really good material here, just on those names alone.
No. Great recommendation, definitely. I only picked it up a couple of a year or so ago. I think it was on an Halloween sale or something like that.
Yeah,
Definitely something that I want to talk about on the Long Box of Darkness, but we might also be able to do that on Into the Weird, Billy, because lots of those comics are weird, but they're not especially horror. I'd say the magazine featuring the Monster Frankenstein stories, like Monsters Unleashed, has got a couple of Frankenstein stories in there. That is more horror, but the comic book proper, that was more Into the Weird. So, within our wheelhouse for this podcast. So we'll get to that. Okay, Billy, now I've got something that I've reread recently, but I bought them about a year or two ago that I want to recommend. Now, this is not Marvel titles, but it's definitely bizarre. So odd enough to be included in Into the Weird, the Recommendations of Ragador segment. This is a series called Space Riders. And published by Black Mask Studios. And the creators on this is Fabian Rangel Jr. and Alex Zerit. So they're indie creators. And this is a wonderful two-trade series. You can pick up the entire series in two trades, or you can pick it up on Comixology digitally. Basically, Billy, this series is so great. I love it so much. It's about a space captain. Think Captain Kirk, but think a lawless, even more lawless Captain Kirk. But, you know, with strong Spanish influence. For instance, this guy, he refuses to be called Captain. He insists on being called Capitan. And his name is Capitan Peligro, right? And he is crewing this ship called the Santa Muerte. Now, this is a giant black skull spaceship. This is a spaceship in the shape of a giant black skull that traverses space. And it's very Ditko-esque. I mean, the way that they draw space here. And I think the artist on this is a guy called Ferrier. Art is by Alex Zerit. And it's lettered by Ryan Ferrier. The lettering is a big part of this because you've got some great sound effect here. So you've got this Capitan Peligro, and he's of Spanish descent, and he's the most badass of the space badasses you've ever encountered. Basically, he flies around space, destroys space pirates. He's out for revenge because he was stabbed in the eye by a mutinous crew member. Then he's got this crew of misfits accompanying him. Get this, Billy. One of them is a mandrill called Mono.
Oh, boy.
a humanoid mandrill monkey guy called Mono. And then you've got this sexy, sleek, robotic medic who's reminiscent of Fritz Lang's Metropolis robot, you know, in the movie Metropolis.
Yeah.
And I think her name was Eve, right? So you've got this robot, and her name's Yara. She's the medic, but she's super sexy. And then they're going on this mission in the Santa Muerte spaceship, and they're fighting these space bikers that's just the first trade. But it's filled with action. It's filled with great scenes. And it's also filled with great lines, Billy. Just listen to this, right? He's injured. The guy, Captain Peligro, he's this bearded guy with this giant scar over his eye. And his one eye is gone, in fact, because, like I said, he was stabbed in the eye. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah. You know, he's been in a coma for months. And finally, you know, he's released. But he's fired from his job because he endangered his crew. So they track him down in this bar. And then they recruit him again to be the captain of his old ship. And the first thing he says when he sees his spaceship is, "Mi amor." This giant skull that's sitting in this desert.
That's great.
And he's also a very foul mouth. So listeners, this is like Vertigo level stuff here. Vertigo publishing level.
We'll put this out again.
Okay, Image? This is Black Mask. Black Mask Publishing. Indie publisher. Yeah, man, find it on Comixology or buy it. I hope these trades are still available. You've got two trades, Volumen Uno and Volumen Dos. Oh, man, it's great. It's just wonderful. So Space Riders from Black Mass Studios. Check that out, listeners.
Yeah, I got to be honest. Like, if I go to a shop, and I still do hit them every once in a while, but if they have a Marvel section, a DC section, and then an indie section, the indie section always does seem to have more books that jump out at me, for sure.
These days, yeah, I agree with you, Billy. I agree with you. Yeah. I don't know why. It's like some things happened within the last decade or so to me. It's changed my perspective. I used to be, you know, all Marvel and DC. I of course I bought IDW and you know, Dark Horse, but you know, they've the importance has shifted for me to, you know, now I'm just enjoying back issues. And Marvel and DC is not the force in my life that they used to be. It's kind of sad because they were so all-encompassing at one point in time. But now,
yeah,
I don't know what's happened. But there are definitely some indie gems out there, this being one of them. Billy, I think you will also like this because, I don't know, it's just way up our alley there. It's strange. It's just full of... I mean, the storyline makes no sense. So sometimes you got to go for something like that just to relax, just to give your mind a bit of a break from the harsh realities that we deal with every day.
Yeah, so, for sure. I think books like that do, obviously, they always have a place on a shelf because not everybody wants, you know, something that's a storyline and gritty and going on for 5-6 issues in a row and this and that. It's nice to have just, you know, one or two issues of a story and just some fun and lightheartedness and wackiness.
Yeah, exactly. No. So at least we've still got that. We still love comics, listeners. That's what we're hinting at here.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never give it up. Whether it's like buying up every single back issue on eBay or whether it's checking out new indie series in trade paperback form, we're still going to be there at the forefront of that part of comics, at least. I hope just comics survives long enough for that still to be a thing.
Yeah, really.
Anyway, so that's it for our Recommendations of Ragador segment, and then with our quick send-off. But don't go away, listeners. After this break, we'll be back.
Oh, no. No, please.
Well, that's it for another episode of Into the Weird. Don't go away yet, listeners, because Billy and I have got a bit of a preview for you for our next upcoming episodes. We've got episode 19 already slated for release, and then we've got episode 20 coming. Billy's going to tell us a little bit about what you can expect from these two future episodes. So take it away, Billy.
Okay, so in episode 20, for all you Doctor Strange fans that really like to follow along with what we do with Doctor Strange, in episode 20, we're going to be covering two books, issues number 11 and 12 of Marvel Premiere, because of the simple fact that, if you didn't know already, issue number 11 is pretty much a reprint issue. What they do is they have like a first and last page with a little bit of new material. It's not real heavy. And then in between, they have two Strange Tales reprint stories in the middle. So we'll breeze through that one pretty quick. So that's why we're going to combine 11 and 12. But then 12 is going to be it's really going to get into some wild stuff that's going to be a good send-off to Marvel premiere in 13 and 14. And me and Herman are going to have a blast with that. You're going to be along for the ride for some really crazy stuff with those.
Wild stuff, Billy? Wild stuff? That's an understatement, man. That's an understatement.
Uh-huh. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and episode 19 then, we're going to be doing a... it's going to be sort of an ancillary kind of Doctor Strange title, The Defenders. Now, we won't reveal which story we're going to talk about, but we're going to talk about a story, not just one specific issue. But hold on to your seats for that one, too, because The Defenders are crazy.
Yes, yes, some Defenders. Favorite superhero team of the Marvel Bronze Age for me, Billy. Okay, so that's it for our... send off here, listeners. We'll leave you with our contact details. You can find me on Twitter at Dark Longbox and our podcast at Into Weird. You can also check out our blog at www.sinkintotheweird.com. And please send us any feedback you want to sinkintotheweird@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And Billy, where can they find you on the interwebs?
As usual, on Twitter at BillyD_Licious, and then at my blog, magazinesandmonsters.com, and a Facebook page by the same name.
Excellent. All right, listeners, we'll leave you with this brief message. Stay weird, stay cool, relish in your strangeness. Don't let anybody talk you down, because being odd is cool. It's awesome. And that's why we love comics and why we love the weird. So... join us again next week, or maybe a week after next week, for another journey into the weird. I would wait forever for those lips of wine. Build my world around you, darling. This love will shine, girl. Watch it and see. If you give a little more than you're asking for, your love will turn the key. Some puppet on a string. Oh, yeah. If I stay here without you, darling, I would die. I want you, lady.